Welcome to Functional Design and Closure. I am Nate Jones.
And I'm Christoph Newman.
We're here to help you use closure and functional programming to make your everyday life as a developer less frustrating and more fulfilling.
That's right. We love using closure, and we'd love to help you use closure too. And this week, we're here to talk about even more closure. I know, big surprise, right? But if you are new to this podcast, we recommend that you start with episode one or go to closuredesign.club to see every series that we have covered. Right now, we're in the middle of our reentrant coding series. So if you're new to this series, you can go on back to episode 114 and check out the beginning of our series.
Yeah, we're talking all about getting back into a code base. Or in my case, I got into a large existing code base when I was hired at my current job. And I had thousands and thousands of lines of code I had to start understanding. And so I got my first task and I was like, all right, I got to go learn everything. I got to go read every single line of code in that entire code base before I started working. Just kidding. But, you know, how do you get into a code base that you have never been a part of? That's what the series is about.
That's right. Can you imagine? Oh, you're the new guy. Okay, here's a really big cup of coffee. Okay, now we just want you to just start at the top and just start reading all the code. Just let us know when you're done, and then we'll give you something to do.
See you in 6 months.
Right. Stories from an alternate universe. Right. Well, in my case, I was diving back into my own code base. This is code that I wrote, but somehow looked unfamiliar to me. I don't know how that happened.
Exactly.
And so it took a while, but fortunately, I had left myself a trail of crumbs. I had left myself some structures and conventions to help along. And part of that is why we are doing this series.
Wait.
We both had these experiences.
Well, hold on. So, are you saying your code was crummy? Sorry.
It was crummy in the best possible way.
Yes. In a I can survive way, not in a bad, yeah.
Yes. Well, if something is littered with breadcrumbs, does that make it crummy? If it does, then please write crummy code.
So yeah, so last time in this series, we started talking about pure models. We had initially talked about like just how do we even find ourselves, but we really want to dive into what pure models, pure data models are, and at the core of your application, you know, the core applications that we write these pure data models that allow us to encapsulate a lot of the business logic, a lot of the reason why our application exists, and we put it all in that place and we make it pure. And the reason why we make it pure is like the whole overarching purpose of this series is to talk about how we can understand code, how we can understand something when we come back to it, or when it's new for the first time. And when there's a pure data model is something that is both wide enough to handle an actual use case and be useful, but it's shallow enough that you can understand it and trust the function calls that it has. All of the, you know, the operations on that data are in the same namespace, and so it's easier to understand when you get back into it. So that's kind of the reason why we have pure data models in the first place.
Right. And last time we were extolling all sorts of virtues of pure models, but what does that really mean in the code? You want to sit down, you want to write a pure data model. So what are you writing? What? How do you go about it? And we've noticed some patterns over time, as we've written many, many pure data models in functional programming, because we don't want those side effects. And so we've noticed some patterns to these pure data models. And in closure, our organizing unit is a namespace. And so the idea is this pure data model, it will have a namespace, and then you're going to have a bunch of functions in that namespace. Or maybe if you have a lot of functionality for this pure model, you might have some sub namespaces. Maybe one for I/O if you have to do a lot of I/O for getting data or whatever, right? But you're going to have this namespace and you're putting all these functions in this namespace together. Mm-hmm. And they all have a kind of a common data that they're operating on. And so we're going to call that the pure data model, that collection of functions in a namespace operating on a well-known data tree, right? So kind of at a high level. And so in this namespace, you're going to need some kind of notion of what the tree is, like what the data is. It could just be a map. It could be nested maps sometimes. You might have a schema that defines, you know, enforcement for the information in that tree.
Mm-hmm.
If this is a stateful model, meaning it's keeping track of something over time, you might have an initial state defined in that structure, right? And then you're going to have predicate functions, which answer questions about that data model and often end with a question mark. I know there are predicates because they end in a question mark. You're going to have other operations where you're transforming the data. Maybe you're going to have a special kind of operation where it's a reducing function. It's going to take a state and it's going to take some other information like an event or an operation, and it's going to update that and return a new version of the data, which is a new state. So it's a reducing mm-hmm. function, takes two arguments, right? Or you might have some special functions where you have some IO off to the side that reads some raw information, and you have a transform that extracts all the best stuff from that and turns it into your pure data model. Or you might have your pure data model as a source and you want to transform that into some kind of output for storage or communicate with some other system. So your pure transforms ins and outs. And then other kinds of views of the data, right? So just kind of at a high level, these different parts, the structure of it, perhaps an initial state, predicate questions, operations on that data, special operations called reducing functions, transforms in, transforms out, and then views of that data where you're summarizing or gathering. So that's kind of the broad brush overview of that.
Yeah, and I think it's important to highlight kind of as we go through these different things, different parts, is that there's somewhat of a fuzzy analogy between a pure data model and an object in object-oriented programming, as in the data that is in the pure data model and all of these different kinds of functions. I mean, you just went through a whole long list of all these different words, but all of them are just functions. You know, that's the wonderful thing about closure is it's all just functions. But they all have different roles and different purviews, but they all know what the internal data structure of the model is. And that internal data structure is kind of like instance variables. Sorry, I don't remember the right terminology. The instance variables in an object. But the difference is that it's all pure data. There's no mutation that happens under the hood. And all of these functions know where in this data tree or this, you know, it could be a flat map, could be a nested map, whatever, it needs to get the information to perform its duty. And then because all of the necessary changes and views and all that stuff is all encapsulated, it's encapsulated in this namespace, that means the rest of your application can rely on these higher level operations. So when working with the data model, so that it doesn't have to, it's both not burdened with the internal knowledge, but the internal knowledge can change because all of the, like if you go, oh, I want to put this in a different part of the data tree or something like that, all you have to do is update the function in this namespace. You don't have to go worry about where in the rest of your code that might be that particular subtree is used, because the rest of your code uses these higher level functions. And that's the point, is these are higher level vocabulary of your application type of functions instead of just the core data ones. And so that's kind of the mentality as we go through this.
That's right. And so elsewhere in the code, you're going to have some binding, presumably named after the pure data model itself. And
right.
So I've been working quite a lot in this code base with video streams, like audio video streams over the internet, right? And so mm-hmm. I have a data model that I call flows, which is all a collection of a bunch of different streams, right? And so each of these flows has a flow. It's a list, And so I have information about all the flows in general and then information about each flow. And so I have a namespace called flow. And I can import that in other code. And so then when I have a variable flows, a binding flows, I can go, oh, I want to work with flows. So let me import this. And now I have a bunch of functions that can help me deal with this data structure, right? Can help me find specific video flows, right? Mm-hmm. Based on matching criteria. It can help me summarize. I can add flows to the list. I can take flows out of the list. So I can do those kind of operations. So you're just importing and you're using the functions that are in that data model to help you. You're not reaching into this structure using something like Spectre or something like that, where you're like reaching in and manipulating the tree sort of on like out of band, right?
Yeah.
Like if work needs to get done with the data, with this pure model, go write a function and put it in that namespace and then use that function. That way, everything that can be done is all co-located in this namespace.
Mm-hmm. And it's a higher level of abstraction than something low level like Clojure Core or even Spectre. And it's something like, you know, get flow or, you know, add flow instead of, you know, associate. Associate and add flow probably do the same thing. Like the add flow might actually be just a one line associate. But because it's in that namespace, it lets you as a programmer in the rest of your application think at a higher level. And when you can think at a higher level that's trusted, it's lower cognitive load. Also, it means that when you come back to the code later, you can, oh, add flow. I understand what add flow means in the context of my application. Instead of being like associate, and you got to look at the keys and what the data is, like you have to unpack, you have to be a Clojure interpreter. But that's hard because that's already written. Rich wrote that.
Right.
We should operate at a level that's at our application.
Right. And so am I multiplying by 0.10 or 0.15, or am I calculating a tip? Right?
Exactly.
One of those has more information, and or maybe 0.2. No judgment here. So depending on where you land in that spectrum.
0.5. Wow, you're generous.
0.5. Nice. 0.05.
Oh, yeah.
In terms of what is possible, this is where schema can come into play, and that can live in that data model too, right? And so object types are kind of like a poor man's schema, but not great, right? When you have types for each field, because you can express so much more information on the range of possibilities using a schema than you can just simply with a type. Just because it's an int, I mean, maybe that int has to only be positive. And you're like, oh, well, I have unsigned int. Yeah, but maybe it has to be smaller than 100 and bigger than 1, right? So you can do these things with schema that you can't. So so in terms of defining the data tree itself, that's where schemas help. They can help define this is what is possible. But then if you have some kind of like initial state for this data model, because it's going to change over time, that's another way you can kind of define. Like, this is what is possible, right? Or you can, if you don't have a schema, it's very simple. You just have your initial state. You look at it, you go, okay, here are the fields that exist. And then you can look down through the file and see how it's used.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really where these core data models start off, is with data. It's right in the name there. And if you have a data tree and an initial state, sometimes you have a function that makes an initial state or the schema around it. You have to have some notion in there when you're reading that file specifically of what the data structure looks like. And so that's kind of one of the things that's common to almost every pure data model, is that you have to have some notion of what the data looks like. You know, I mean,
right. That way you know what's legal, what's not, you know how it's organized, is it nested, is it very flat, and all that. And so then predicates are really useful, because if you want to use this model as part of a conditional, I almost end up always writing some kind of predicate in the end.
Right.
Because if you're reaching down into the guts of this pure model and you know, pulling data out, sometimes that's a code smell for, oh, I should have a predicate that asks this question at a logical semantic level instead. So in the case of these flows, I want to know, is it connected or not?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So maybe there's a state field that has a nominal in it that I get from, you know, the video hardware that tells me what's going on with these video transmissions. But if I have a predicate called flow/connected? I can read that and go, oh, okay. And I don't have to understand the internals of that data structure per se, right? And so it keeps it very semantic.
Well, and it makes so that when you change that data model, because the world, you learn more about the world. So say, yes, so you have a state flag inside your data model that is connected, but then you learn that this particular piece of hardware will set state to connected, but then there's another variable called, you know, is the sun up, you know, that also has to be true before, you know, before it actually is connected. Like this happens all the time in external data models where some it'll tell you something and you find out it's not true except for if there's some other variable that you have there. And so if that's in your data model and you've been using a predicate, an actual predicate function, then you can update the predicate function to say, oh, go look at these two different places and return true. But if you've done the get in somewhere in your code, then you have to go look for all the places you've done that get in and update them. So again, pushing that decision back into the data model with a predicate, like that's one of the reasons why you do it.
Yeah. And so don't underestimate the value of being able to find places where this predicate is used, because that gives you information yes. on what code cares about this situation. So when you have to nuance the situation, you can go look at these call sites and take them all into account. And if you're just reaching in to a data member, you know, reaching into a field and comparing the value of that field equal to something else, it's much harder to find that, right? And so even though it feels silly to have a predicate called connected and then have the body of that be, you know, status equals connected.
Right.
It gives you a different level of semantic information and a different ability to find this in the code and adjust it and modify it. And so it's more than just replacing one line of code with one line of code.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a purpose. It makes it a higher level. And then, yeah, so that's predicates. And we often have lots of predicates because you end up finding lots of questions you want to ask about your data model. Sometimes, yeah, like I have a section, we'll have like a section in the data model. It's like, these are where all the predicates go. And I remember sometimes I'll be making that predicate, that section, and I'll have one little predicate in there. And I'm like, wow, it seems like a lot of ceremony just for one function. And before you know it, there's 30 of them because yes. You need to ask questions because this is, again, the core part. It's at the heart of your application. So everyone needs to ask questions about this. And sometimes they need to ask different questions. And so starting the habit will carry on well in the future.
Yeah. And we often define like the schema as the first thing, if this is a schema or initial state, and then the predicates next. Because we find that we often need these predicates when we're implementing some kind of operation on this data, right? Because we're taking the data model and we're producing a result. Maybe we're doing a special kind of operation, a reducing operation, where we're taking the data model and something else, and we're producing a new version of the data model that still conforms to the schema. Or maybe we're doing another kind of operation where we're taking that and we're creating a view out of it, right? We're cherry picking little bits of information and emitting a data structure. So like select keys in the core function, you think of that as a view, right? You have a map, you have all this information, and I want to pick a subset of it out and produce that, right? So select keys is like a view of the original thing.
Right.
But obviously we want more advanced views sometimes, or we want summaries of things. So for example, I could have an operation that gives me the most extreme flows. So I could have the newest flow and the oldest flow, the flow with the highest bit rate and the flows with the lowest bit rate, right? So extreme flows would be the operation and I get it back and it would tell me something, right? So there's different kinds of operations, but often you have questions or decisions you need to make in there. And so these predicates start to emerge. And so I start adding more and more predicate functions as I need them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we find that the data operations are lots of times things that you want to are oftentimes used when you have a reducing function. So like when you're taking in a stream of information and you want to keep a state of, you know, you want to materialize a view across those events. In the past, we've worked with video game data, and so we want to know, like, as we get game events, we want to keep track of the score and which teams have died or not died, or how many times they've died or whatever. And so over time, you want to keep taking each of those new events. So that's what we use a reducing function for. We take a state, you know, this is usually where we get where we have an initial state. Initial state is like, you know, everything's zero and where the teams aren't set, you know, and then you can say, hey, here's a new event. Oh, team A is in. So then you use in the reducing function, you call a data operation to modify the state. And in that data operation, you might call a predicate to make sure that the data is correct or whatever. And so these functions kind of build off each other. So even inside your pure data model, you're using the language of your application that's in these low-level predicates and data operations to make higher-level things happen, like keep track of a game state across a series of events.
Right. And so then the different things that can alter that game state, those are the second parameters in your reducing function. And you can have more than one reducing function depending on the different kinds of scenarios. And so, but then the information has to come from somewhere. And so you're going to have some kind of transforms in and transforms out. Right. And so maybe this data model ends up being an amalgamation of other data models. And so your transform in takes a bunch of other pure models and collects information out of them or caches some subtrees of them or whatever and produces itself. Or maybe you have some kind of external source. So for my project, I have to pull video hardware and video software and get statistics and state information. And so I have to do these HTTP calls to pull these JSON API endpoints. And so then I have a bunch of very raw information. I have a HTTP response and headers and bodies and
data, right? That data is not in the right format for your application. Shocker.
Right. And so then I have a transform. And so I often put these transforms in a different file. It depends on how complex it is, right? But I have a transform that can take all these raw HTTP responses and give me something that conforms to my data model, right, for that. And so if I hit an endpoint called, you know, in the API that gives me, you know, transmission stats, and then all of a sudden I have all this information, I can take that raw. And so it's good to know that even though it's very unstructured from your application's point of view, that's still pure data. Once you've made the HTTP call, all the information about what the request was and what the response was and what the body was and all that, that's pure data. And you can do a pure transform from that domain of the raw external HTTP information into the internal domain of flows or players or scores or whatever the pure data model is about.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And then conversely, on the way out, say you need to take some of your data from your model and you need to post it to an external, you know, you need to go update some external API to post that into so people can see it on a Jumbotron or something. Like you need to send that data out. Well, that data being sent out is not going to be what your internal data structure is. And so the transform out would be one that takes your data tree and the output of that because it's pure transform. It output of that would be a web request. Like it's like just like you said, on the way in, the web response is pure and you're transforming it in, but then transforming it out, you can transform it from pure data to pure data. And then you can just send it to, you know, the request function that sends it to the right place. But because it's a pure function, starts a pure transform. It makes it a lot easier to test. Like all these things are much easier to test because they're all pure. But then it makes it so that the IO is a very, very thin layer, both on the way in and the way out. Like it's just, you know, webs, your HTTP/request done, HTTP/response. Like it's very, very minimal.
That's right. And so it's very useful to have all of that context on the way in and on the way out, right? Instead of doing some thinking and then IO and then more thinking and then IO and then IO and more thinking, et cetera, right? You're trying to do as much IO as you can at kind of at a shot to get a big bag of information that's pure that you can work with. And then on the way out, you want to do a big pure transform to generate all the things you're going to need for the IO, the full request. And so then if you're debugging, all of a sudden you have every variable that matters at hand, right? On the way in or on the way out. You have all the information. Because if you don't elide the response headers, and then you realize like, I'm having a weird thing. And then you are able to go, oh, I can look at the response headers because I didn't just throw them away as I did sort of some processing on the way in. You know, you collect up everything. And then you work with it all in one big pure transform.
Yeah, just because we're transforming data doesn't mean we need to remove data or leave data out. The nice thing about Clojure is you can just keep accumulating information and even put it in certain places of your data model so that the data model is easy to inspect, but is not necessarily using that part of the data model to answer the questions. You know what I mean? Like it's like you can just have this big bag of extra context that's there for you with a programmer, but that the program doesn't need. It's very useful.
So over time, you know, we've noticed different patterns even of data models themselves. So even though we're talking about these different parts that are pretty common, we know some different patterns. And so we'll have to talk about that more. I think we're out of time, though, for this episode.
Cool. Yeah, that was a lot of fun talking about the different parts of the data model. If there's any parts that you think we missed or you have questions about one of them, please do reach out to us on Clojure Design Podcast on the Clojurian Slack. We'd love to talk with you there. We love creating threads and talking about different things. Please join us. You can also send us a post on x.com at Clojure Design or an email to feedback@clojuredesign.club. We will get your information from wherever you send it and we will respond, I promise.
That's right. We'd love to hear from you. And so don't hesitate to reach out. Also, you can go to closuredesign.club to see all of our past series and show notes for this episode and all the other episodes. If you're looking for some more material or you want some more stuff to listen to, just head on over to closuredesign.club.
Yep. All right. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.